Joining us, Daryl West, a senior fellow at Brookings Institute in Washington, D.C., formerly over from Brown University. Good morning, Daryl.
Good morning, Frank. How are you?
I'm doing fine. And how are you?
I'm doing fine. It is hot in D.C., not just weather-wise, but politically.
I see where we're going to, federal government is now going to annex Washington, D.C., and possibly New York City.
I saw that news report. I'm sure that sends shudders throughout D.C. City government, because we have a mayor, we have a city council. They are not going to like a Trump takeover of the city if that happens.
Well, but we're changing the whole landscape here, because we get the Panama Canal, we have the Gulf of America, and Canada will be a state, as well as I'm not sure how we're going to designate Greenland. But it means that I don't need my passport anymore.
You can travel up and down North America.
Bizarre, just bizarre. So I was going to ask you a kind of a broad question. Can you help me make sense of all of this? Or is there any way to do that?
But there's so many crazy things taking place. I mean, Trump has just pushed the envelope in so many different directions: domestic policy, foreign policy, trade policy, the tariffs, and so on. About election night, he claimed he had a mandate, and he's acting as if he won a 10-point or 20-point victory when he actually won by less than 1.5 points. So I do think he's doing a lot of things that are unpopular. They're going to catch up with him next year and probably in 2028 for the party. But he is just rolling it along as if all of America supports him.
How confident are you that we will have elections, midterm elections next year, and not a claim from president's office of martial law?
I am confident we will have midterm elections next year. Trump can do many things. He's done many outrageous things. Declaring martial law and canceling the elections, I don't think is something that he will contemplate. I can't imagine even the Supreme Court, which is very conservative and has given him a number of favorable rulings, would go along with that.
What is the danger that persists with a Supreme Court that now acts much like an arm of the executive branch rather than as a somewhat of a watchdog?
The whole separation of powers problem has just gotten really intense in recent years. The Supreme Court has a 6-3 conservative majority. Trump doesn't win all the time, but he's won a lot of times before the Supreme Court. They've kind of exempted him from legal liability for anything he does as president, which basically means he can do whatever he wants. He's expanded executive authority, and they have ratified that up and down the line. Republicans should be really cautious about this, because at some point we're going to have a Democratic president. They're going to rue the day that Congress and the courts basically are allowing presidents to do whatever they want. They're not going to like it if a Democratic president comes along and does all the sorts of things and expands executive powers in the same way that Trump has.
So I remember the days when guys like Tip O'Neill and John Chafee would have little problem in crossing the aisle or working with a president of a different political party and be able to make legislation. At some point in time, that stopped. And we have this line that you just don't cross. On very rare occasion might you get what we call now bipartisan. We call bipartisan legislation when one congressional person from the other party happens to vote your way. It's not really bipartisan. It's by luck, I think. When did that happen? How did that happen? And how do we get back?
I mean, I think it started to change in the late 1990s with Newt Gingrich. Republicans had been in the House minority for, I think, more than 40 years at that point. And Gingrich basically was a bomb thrower who said, look, we've got to shake things up. We have to make politics more personal, more nasty. He went after then Speaker Jim Wright for alleged misconduct. And since then, we have engaged in what Bill Clinton used to call the politics of personal destruction, where you go after the person. It's kind of an all-out war against the opposition. And polarization has just really intensified since then. So Trump is really just the manifestation of trends that have been developing over a long period of time. It's really hard to know how we get back to that because, as you point out, there actually are almost no Republican moderates left. There are a handful of people here and there, but they are afraid of Trump. They've actually openly admitted that they're afraid of him. The reason Trump has been so successful in keeping his party in line is these moderates are afraid that Trump is going to primary them, that he's going to find some prominent conservative candidate to run against them and beat them in a Republican primary. So I don't think they worry so much about a general election, but they worry a lot about a party primary that will end up booting them out of office.
Are they not missing what their job really is? That it's not about maintaining power and winning an election, but in fact serving the nation. And so they put principles aside just to retain their own power.
That is exactly right. That's a perfect critique of what is happening now. I mean, I remember the days when legislators tried to solve problems. And if it required working with the opposition party, they would do that in order to get things done. And certainly the John Chafee example that you cited was a good illustration of that. We've lost sight of that. People are worried about their own individual circumstances and less about serving the country. They're less worried about kind of violating long-held norms in American politics that have held our democracy together. And they're just more interested in winning and exercising raw political power. It's hard to know where that ends up. I think everybody's really worried about, some of the scenarios that you mentioned. But I still am optimistic about the United States in the longer run. This is obviously a rough patch we're going through right now, but I think Democrats are going to do very well next year and probably in 2028. And the longer-term situation is more optimistic than what we're seeing right now.
So you are of the group that believes that democracy will survive.
I do, although I certainly recognize it is facing dramatic challenges right now. There's going to be a lot of damage inflicted over the next few years because Trump basically is going to do whatever he wants. Congress is not going to stop him. It doesn't appear that the Supreme Court is going to stop him. So we're all going to deal with the carnage of that. But the good news is many of the things he's doing are very unpopular with the American public. The budget bill that Congress passed last week is going to seriously harm people's health care, particularly in the poor states and particularly in Republican areas. They're going to be rural hospitals that close. Millions of people are going to lose health care coverage. I think people are going to be shocked that the person they voted for actually is inflicting this kind of harm on them. Trump completely overestimates the popularity of what he's doing, and it's going to be his own personal hubris that actually does him in.
I've reached out to a number of homeless shelters as well as food banks to ask them what they saw the ramifications of this big, beautiful bill will be on their operations and on their clients. And just certainly what I'm getting back is great concern over Rhode Island Food Bank is losing 500,000 pounds of food a year. And that even came before this big, beautiful bill. And those agencies being in jeopardy in some cases, and certainly their clients in jeopardy. And I presume that's going to be an absolute offshoot of this big, beautiful bill.
Absolutely. There are going to be problems for people who are hungry. There are going to be huge problems for people who need medical care. Even people who are applying to medical school, like one of the small provisions that didn't get a lot of attention at the time it was passed, is they have put a cap on the amount of the loans med school students can get, and it's way below what medical school actually costs. And so it's going to harm the supply of doctors. Like we already have a big shortage of doctors and nurses in many places around the country, I think including in Rhode Island. It's going to get a lot worse because the pipeline is going to diminish because of the caps put on medical student loans.
One of the problems in Rhode Island is that our Medicaid reimbursement for docs in Rhode Island is less than that of docs in Massachusetts or in Connecticut. So you actually have some primary care physicians who live in Rhode Island but will work in Connecticut or Massachusetts because there's better compensation.
Yeah, I think the problem in Rhode Island on access to medical care is going to get very acute. I mean, I've heard many of the things that you just talked about doctor and nursing shortages. But many of the things that Trump is doing is actually going to make that situation worse, both in Rhode Island as well as in many other places across the country, including in a lot of Republican states.
I wanted to test my theory about immigration in that we know predictions are that in the not too distant future, that whites will become the minority in this country. And when I took a look at some research on the 2020 census, it seemed to become much clearer to me. When I looked at the 18 and under population, in this country, the 18 and under population in the white population was something like 47%, and the of color population is, as they describe it, 53%. And then I took a look at two states where they were putting people on planes and bringing them wherever, Texas and Florida. In Florida, if my memory serves me correct, they have 39% of their 18 and under population is white and 61% is of color. In Texas, those numbers are more like 31% and 69%, but much larger. So that those governors are looking at populations that are going to shift for certain as this population becomes the voting population. Am I correct, at least in part, that is much of the fear with immigration?
I think you're completely correct on that, and you're exactly right in your demographic projections. Basically, within about 20 years, America is going to be officially majority-minority, meaning if you add up the African-Americans, Hispanics, and Asian-Americans, they're going to constitute a majority in America. That's going to have profound consequences on our politics. I think somebody like Trump, he can only get elected at this particular moment. Like even 10 years from now, somebody like him running on that kind of anti-immigrant platform is just, it's not going to be possible. So it's one of the things that actually makes me optimistic on a longer term basis, that the demographic shifts as well as the generational shifts, like there's a big age gap in terms of people's liberalism. Young people tend to be more liberal, senior citizens tend to be more conservative. Within 20 years between the demographic and the generational changes, somebody like to be impossible. And also some of the political reforms that we need to undertake that seem impossible now are actually going to be possible. So it's going to be a rough decade ahead as we make this transition. But as you point out, if you just look at the babies being born now, the population under the age of 18, the trend line is very clear. And some of those states that are actually pretty strongly anti-immigrant right now, their politics are going to change too. And this would include places like Texas. And I think Republicans may rue some of the political positions that they're taking now. It's going to be really problematic for them in about 10 years.
So you had mentioned earlier, and it's certainly an observation that I've made, that the more moderate Republicans have basically, I'm not going to say they've gone into hiding, but they've disappeared. They left Congress and they went off. And unlike Liz Cheney, who has been, and I wouldn't call her a moderate Republican, she certainly was very strong philosophically for conservative principles. But also she was incredibly courageous and honest and had a great deal of integrity. But many of them disappeared. Why did they disappear? And are they, or is there a hope for a different Republican Party going out into the future?
There's a hope for a different Republican Party, not right now, but probably 5 to 10 years from now, as the demographic trends that we were just talking about start to unfold, the generational trends start to unfold. The Republican Party will not be able to win national elections based on the stances they have now in the not too distant future. And it's one of the reasons I think some Republicans have moved in favor of voter suppression. Like they can see the handwriting on the wall, And as opposed to adapting to that reality, they're trying to suppress that vote that is clearly starting to increase. I don't think that's going to be a winning proposition for them in the long run. I don't think America is going to embrace anti-democracy. I don't think America is going to like becoming an authoritarian country. I just think a lot of the positions that Republicans are pushing now, they work right now. They're not going to work in the very near future.
I wanted to shift gears ever so slightly into the media and watchdogs. We have, with this administration, eliminated a lot of watchdog positions within the administration. And also, at the same time, our media has devolved, if you will, into one of social media, into one of misinformation. How do we respond? One of the things, the beauty of this radio station here in Westerly, is we help keep this area from becoming a news desert. But there are many news deserts around this country. Is there any hope for a different media going forward?
Well, I applaud the work that you're doing. I think it's really important that local communities have a good source of news, and clearly you're providing that. But you're right, the whole media ecosystem has shifted in very dangerous ways. Just last year, I co-authored a book entitled Lies That Kill about the threat of disinformation and all the false narratives that are circulating and gaining currency and actually affecting our politics and elections. Clearly is a huge problem. But people just have to be aware in this information environment, they can't just accept everything they're hearing from news sources. There's just so many myths that are circulating, so much false information that is affecting how people think. People just need to grow up and understand the internet is a dangerous place. There's a lot of dangerous things that are taking place there. And I do think, like, when you look at the history of technology innovation, it often takes a while for the technology to catch up and the policymaking to catch up. But eventually, people do recognize the risk of new technologies and they start to adapt. They become more consumer conscious. We will have laws that are put in place that start to regulate the worst abuses. There's a lot of crime that is not navigated to the internet. I mean, every day, I, and I'm sure you're probably getting the same thing, are getting phishing expeditions, trying to steal my money, get my bank account information, and so on. And so I think people understand the internet is now a dangerous place, and they're becoming more cautious. So in the longer run, people will kind of build up their own defenses. But right now, we are at a very vulnerable point.
I urge people to go to the fact-checking sources like PolitiFact, factcheck.org, Snopes, the BBC, Media Watch Fact Check, all of these places that I think do a pretty good job of monitoring some of these things. But that takes a lot of work that people didn't have to do on their own before, that they left to the local newspapers and radio stations and TV stations. One last question, Daryl, as we were almost out of time. What's your message to people out there today who are worried about where we are at, and some who just simply take in every piece of misinformation if it somehow feeds their belief? Is there an overall message somewhere?
I mean, the message that I will tell people that I hope will make them feel better about the current situation is there is a backlash building against many of these negative trends that we're seeing: Trump's authoritarianism, the rise of disinformation, the media fragmentation that we're seeing, the extreme polarization that we are experiencing. Like, people are now, I think, starting to get organized against this stuff. There are new fact checkers that are rising. There's, you know, the mass protests that we saw the weekend of Trump's infamous military parade, I found very encouraging. There were actually very few people who attended the parade. There were millions of people across America who came out to protest many of these things that we are talking about. So people should not feel helpless. They should not feel hopeless. There's actually stuff going on that I think things are going to get better.
Daryl, you've written, 20, how many books now?
Several, yes.
a lot more than I've ever read. Been a long time. It's great to see you, and we will catch up soon. Thank you for being with us this morning.
Thank you, Frank, and keep up all of your great work.